Today is March 30th, 2018. And tonight, the Venerable Bhante Vilma Ramsey is going to read from the Majjhima Nikaya 111, the Anapanasutta.
Now, this is a real important sutta because it shows that while you're in jhana, you're practicing the four foundations of mindfulness at that time. There are some people that are saying, well, this isn't actually from the Buddha's teaching, because the Chinese, the name they give for their suttas is agamas. And supposedly all of the suttas are agamas in the Chinese literature. And this is the one sutta that's not in it. But this sutta agrees with probably 30 other suttas. So if it wasn't in the original text, it still agrees with it. So, and this is one of my favorite suttas because it explains the whole path. So, thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Anath and Pindika's Park. There he addressed the monks thus. Monks, venerable sir, they replied, the Blessed One said this. Monks, Sariputta is wise. Sariputta has great wisdom. Sariputta has wide wisdom. Sariputta has joyous wisdom. Sariputta has quick wisdom. Sariputta has keen wisdom. Sariputta has penetrative wisdom. And again, anytime you hear wise or wisdom, it's referring to dependent origination. During half a month, monks, Sariputta gained insight into states one by one as they occurred. Now, Sariputta's insight into states one by one as they occurred was this. Here, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, Sariputta entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thinking and examining thought with joy and happiness born of seclusion. And the states in the first jhana, the thinking, the examining thought, the joy, the happiness, and the unification of mind. The contact, feeling, perception, formations, and mind. Now, instead of saying body, it says contact here. Because when you get into the deeper states and you start to experience the arupa states, you don't have a body anymore. It's a strictly mental state. We'll get into that in a little bit. The four foundations of mindfulness and the five aggregates are different ways of saying the same thing. You have body. Okay, you have contact here, but you have body. That's the same. You have feeling. Feeling is not emotion. Feeling is pleasant, painful, neither painful nor pleasant. You have perception. Now, feeling and perception are always conjoined. They always come together. When a pleasant feeling comes up, your mind says, that's a pleasant feeling. That's perception that names that feeling, that kind of feeling. If it's a painful feeling, your mind says, that's painful. Or it's neutral. So, you have formations, and formations are the same as mind objects. And you have consciousness. So these five aggregates, when feeling and perception are together, turned into the four foundations of mindfulness. And this is talking about when you're in the first jhana. The enthusiasm, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention. These states were defined by him one by one as they occurred. Known to him, those states arose. Known they were present. Known they disappeared. So, while you're in the jhana, you're seeing impermanence. Things come up by themselves, they're there for a little while, they disappear. He understood thus, so indeed these states not having been come into being, having been they vanish. Regarding those states, he abided unattracted. He didn't hold on to any of these states. Unrepelled. He didn't push away any of these states, even if it hurts. Independent. He's seeing the true nature of it. This is not me. This is not mine. This I am not. Detached. Again, not attached to anything. Free. Free from any kind of craving. Dissociated with a mind rid of barriers. When you're sitting and you get into a jhana, one of the things that can happen is you can have a lack of mindfulness. Your mindfulness is not very sharp. And as soon as that happens, a hindrance appears. Now, when that happens, you're not in the jhana at that time. Okay, so what that means is you need to siksar and relax and smile and come back to your object of meditation, because you're not in that jhana anymore. You have to come back to it. So, Sariputta understood there is an escape beyond this first stage of meditation. It's real interesting the kinds of definitions that we've been taught over the years from just hearing so many other people talk about, well, jhana means concentration. No, jhana does not mean concentration. Jhana means a level of your understanding. Understanding what? You're teaching yourself about hindrances when they arise and what to do with them. You're teaching yourself how to purify your mind. You're teaching yourself how to have a steady observation. So when somebody tries to tell you jhana is concentration, no. I actually don't like to use the word concentration because it's so misunderstood in this country. Concentration seems to always mean one-pointed concentration or absorption concentration. So when you hear Dhamma talks, and they're talking about concentration and how, well, you have to practice Vipassana meditation. That's the only way to attain Nibbana. They're talking about a kind of meditation that the Buddha did not teach. And they call it jhana. And the word jhana, after some studying, I found out that the word jhana was not actually used before the Buddha. Now, I was shocked at this, because I always was thinking that people doing one-pointed concentration, they have jhanas too, and they have some similar kinds of states that arise. But it wasn't called jhana during the time of the Buddha until he became the Buddha. And he started keying this. It's like the word samadhi. The Buddha did not teach that samadhi is one-pointed concentration. Sama, tranquil, di, wisdom. Okay, he made this word up to describe a different kind of practice than anybody else was using. But after the Buddha died a couple hundred years and Asoka became a Buddhist, he started really giving the best food to the monks and the best clothing and the best areas to have a monastery, and built monasteries for them. And the Brahmins started to get very jealous. So they just started putting robes on so they could get some of that. And after a while, there was no teaching from the monks that wasn't Brahman. And that's why the Third Buddhist Council took place, because the Brahmins were infiltrating what the Buddha was, the Buddhists were gaining by being a Buddhist. Good food, nice clothes, good place to stay. Not that they really wanted that, but that's what Asoka did. So the Third Buddhist Council is rather an infamous council, because this is where all of a sudden Abhidhamma appeared. Until the Third Buddhist Council, which was 250 years after the Buddha died, all of a sudden, instead of a dupitika, vinaya, rules of discipline, and suttas, it came a tipitika, and they threw in Abhidhamma. And it's real interesting, because anybody that really looks deeply and studies, they know that that's not the actual teaching of the Buddha. It was added later, 250 years after the Buddha died. But the monks really like it, and they keep on adding new books and things like that. And that's the studies. And now what's happening in Sri Lanka in particular is they have Sunday school for the kids. So they have a standardized book that they have to go to and use. And they have to take tests on what they've learned at Sunday school. And if they pass the test, it's real easy for them to get a job with the government. And they've taken that the teaching of the Buddha and turn it into an Abhidhamma class. And if you go to the children and you say, okay, you've studied all this Abhidhamma, are you going to use that ever? No, we're just doing it so we can get good jobs. And the actual teaching of the Buddha is very low on the list of things that they learn. And as a result, Buddhism in Sri Lanka is disappearing. It's sad, because this is supposed to be the center of Buddhism. I mean, I ever since I started practicing, that's what it was. You don't go to Thailand, don't go to Burma, go to Sri Lanka. But it's not that way anymore. If you go to the universities as a monk so that you can get a master's or a PhD, they don't teach any suttas to speak of. They have one part of one semester that they talk about four suttas. All the rest of it is Abhidhamma. So the monks that are getting educated, and they are fairly smart people. I mean, to get a PhD is not easy. And they have to write a dissertation and they have to do all of that. But they're not very good with English. When England was ruling Sri Lanka, they got the Sri Lankans really mad. They finally got kicked out of Sri Lanka. And then they made a law that you can't teach English, you have to teach only Sri Lankan. And now they have to write their dissertation in English. And it's about 9th or 10th grade English that they use. So it's very difficult. But getting back to the jhana practice, a lot of people in this country are taught that you can't attain nibbana by practicing jhana practice, which is rather shocking because it's mentioned thousands of times in the text themselves. This is how you attain nibbana. So there's something that's not quite right with a lot of the teaching. And listening to a lot of people give Dhamma talks, it's very confusing. It's not very accurate to the Buddha's teaching. A lot of people that teach meditation, they want to teach from their heart without knowing anything about what the Buddha said. they won't look at the suttas very often. When I came back from 12 years of being in Asia, and I started reading the suttas, oh, that was not liked at all. And it's only taken, let's see, I came back in 98, and this is 18, so that's 20 years. Finally, there's starting to be people taking an interest in what the Buddha said. Now you start to have groups come together and they're starting to read the suttas and discuss and things like that. So, the Buddha actually was the one that explained the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. None of the other teachers at that time knew anything about the jhanas. They were able to get into some very deep states of meditation, but it was absorption concentration that they were doing. And when the Buddha went off trying to learn about mental development and that sort of thing, he got into nothingness and he got into neither perception nor non-perception, but he didn't have any of the lower jhanas that he went through first. This was after he became awakened. He showed how this practice on the night of his awakening had the four jhanas in it. But that was strictly his teaching. Now the Brahmins have taken the word jhana and they put it with all kinds of different practices and they call it jhana practice. But they were stealing the word and giving it different definitions. So that's just a little side note. Okay. He understood there's an escape beyond this, and with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed that there is. So when you get into the first jhana, you experience joy and happiness, equanimity, clarity of mind. You have thinking and examining thought, and you have ekagata, which is a Pali word, that's been broken up into different kinds of definitions. And if you break the word ekagata up, instead of just using the whole word, eka means one. So that implies one-pointed concentration. But when you look in the dictionary, the interesting thing is after the word ekagata, right below it, the word ekaga. Okay, they say one-pointed concentration for ekagata, but right below it, it says ekaga means tranquility. Gets very confusing. Okay, again, with the stilling of thinking and examining thought, Sariputta entered upon and abided in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and stillness of mind, without thinking and examining thought. with joy and happiness born of collectedness. I don't use the word concentration. I change it to collectedness. Now, you've gotten the first jhana, I'm going to tell you now, don't verbalize the wish. Don't say in your mind, may you be happy when you're sending loving kindness. Now, bring up the feeling. Put the feeling in your heart. Put your friend in the middle of that feeling and give them a heart hug. When you get to the second jhana, you start to have a stronger joy. Now, the kind of joy that you experience in these jhanas is called uplifting joy, where you get very light in your mind and light in your body. When you get to the second jhana, you feel so light, you feel like you're floating sometimes. And you start to get more confidence in doing the practice. You start understanding, yeah, I'm feeling like I'm progressing, which is a real nice thing. I did Vipassana for 20 years, and the first 5 years I was trying to figure out what Vipassana was. And I didn't have that much confidence in it. But once you get here, you start feeling like I'm starting to understand. See, this is another level of your understanding. It becomes more clear that your mind will stay on your object of meditation for a little bit longer. And you actually start to have more confidence in what you're doing while you're doing it, using the six R's, recognizing hindrances when they arise. And you start seeing, yeah, this works. It's amazing. A lot of other people doing the practice, different practices, they don't have a relaxed step in it, and without that relaxed step, they're not letting go of craving. And this is a major thing in the Buddhist text. Let go of craving, let go of ignorance. What is ignorance? Ignorance is seeing and understanding deeply what the Four Noble Truths are. And we'll talk about that more in a couple of days. And the states in the second jhana, the self-confidence, the joy, the happiness, and unification of mind, the contact, feeling, perception, formations, and mind. There's your four foundations of mindfulness again. The enthusiasm, and you do get enthusiastic once you start seeing, yeah, I'm practicing, this is good, this is fun. The decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention. These states were defined by him one by one as they occurred. Known to him, those states arose. Known they were present. Known they disappeared. So you're still seeing the three characteristics. You're seeing this while you're in the jhana. He understood that there's still more to do. And with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed that there is. Your mind starts to get lighter. Now, why do you think I try to get you to smile? So your mind can be light. don't push, don't resist. Soften your mind and what? What? Oh, you're afraid to say it? Okay. Again, with the fading away of joy, Sariputta abided in equanimity, mindful and fully aware, still feeling happiness with the body. He entered upon and abided in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce he has a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. Now, the happy feeling, it happens, joy is going to arise, and that's kind of an excited, real happy feeling. And then when that fades away, your mind is going to become more tranquil and comfortable. You feel more at ease. Now, what happens when you get to the third jhana is you start to lose feeling in your body in different places. You don't feel your hands, you don't feel an arm, you don't feel a leg, whatever. And what's happening is, as you let go of tension and tightness in your head, in your mind, you let go of the tension in your body, which is what you feel. So as you go deeper, there's different places in your body that's you're just not going to notice it. If you put your attention on your hands, you're going to feel your hands. But I don't want you to do that. Just let it be by itself. Stay on your object of meditation. Stay with the loving kindness. And you'll keep going deeper, and you'll be able to sit for a longer period of time without any distraction. And eventually, the feeling in your heart disappears. And that feeling of loving kindness will come up into your head. Don't push the loving kindness back down into your heart. I had a lady that she just refused to pay attention to that. And actually, she wound up having to go to a mental institute. She tried so hard to keep the loving kindness in her heart instead of allow things to be. So please, pay attention. Don't push it back down. Okay. And the states in the third jhana, the equanimity, your mind becomes very nice and peaceful and calm and has strong balance in it. Now, when you get to a state like this, a sound can happen, but that sound will just kind of go through you. It doesn't boink you. When you practice one-pointed concentration, a lot of people, especially when they first start to get some nice concentration, they get really angry if there's any sounds at all. Oh, don't let this person walk in front of me while I'm meditating. I hear these sounds. And the reason that that happens is because the concentration is out of balance with the mindfulness. Concentration is too deep, mindfulness not sharp enough. And you hear a sound, somebody closes a door a little bit too loudly and you go, whoa, don't do that. I went to a retreat in Santa Fe with Lee Brazington. And it was a hot time. It was like 90, 92, 93 degrees. And they didn't have air conditioning, so they turned on a fan. So many people practicing one-pointed or absorption concentration wanted to turn the fan off. And finally, I told Lee, no. No, it's way too hot in here. People are going to have real problems if you don't have the air circulating. But it was the noise of the fan that they didn't like. My teacher in Burma, he was continually saying that sounds are a thorn in the side of the meditators. Well, it is if you're out of balance with your mindfulness. And it's not when you're not out of balance. It's not a problem. It's just a sound. What difference does it make whether a sound arises or not? Is that your sound? Did you make that sound come up? Are you taking it personally and not liking what's happening in the present? Who's attached? Okay. The equanimity, the happiness, the mindfulness, the full awareness and unification of mind. Now, the full awareness is when you practice absorption concentration, somebody can come up and they can touch you and you don't know what happened. And that, when you get to the fourth jhana, that's really strong like that. You stop hearing sounds when you get to the fourth jhana. I was in Thailand, there was this little 12-year-old kid that he had great concentration. And he would get into the state of absorption and they would take some chopsticks, bang on him a little bit, hit him in the head, hit him on the arm. Didn't affect him at all, didn't know what happened. They have these really shrill bells that they can use. And if they hit it hard, it's really, you don't like the sound. And they did that right beside his ear. He didn't know it happened. They took his hands and they put them over his head. And they just stayed there. He didn't know it was happening. And eventually they came down on themselves. When they touched part of his body, then they stopped right there. When he came out of the meditation state, he was looking around and said, why are my hands like that? He didn't know it. He didn't have full awareness. But when you're practicing what I'm showing you, a sound is just a sound. It's okay. You'll hear vehicles drive by, motorcycles, you'll know that it happened, but it doesn't make your mind shake and go to it and get caught up in the dissatisfaction of it. So you have full awareness. If I wanted to talk to you while you're sitting and you're in the third jhana, I come up and I say, I need to talk to you. You would hear me, you would understand what I said. And sometimes you'll feel an ant walking across your arm. That happens. You'll know it's there, but it's not a big deal. It doesn't make your mind shake and make you get out of that meditation because there's something happening that you don't like. Okay. Unification of mind. The contact, feeling, perception, formations, and mind. There's the four foundations of mindfulness while you're in the third jhana. The enthusiasm, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention. These states were defined by him one by one as they occurred. Known to him, those states arose. Known they were present. Known they disappeared. He understood there's still more to do. And with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed that there is. So, as you continue on, you're going to stay with your object of meditation for a longer period of time. And the loving kindness comes up into your head. Again, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, Sariputta entered upon and abided in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. Now, what happens when you get to this state? Your mind has very strong balance in it. And again, you're still going to be able to hear things, you're still going to be able to feel things, but they're not going to make your mind wobble or move. Okay, that's fine. It can be like that. When you get to the fourth jhana, that's when I will tell you you have become an advanced meditator. And that's really, you're not a rookie anymore. You're starting to understand very deeply from your direct experience. And you're teaching yourself in each one of these different jhana states. And an insight I had when I was in India is, you know, there's all of these jhanas, and they're all different meditations. It's not just one meditation, because your experience is always changing. So there's four meditations just in the first four jhanas. Now, you won't be feeling your body anymore. If you talk about a pain in your body, actually, I will remind you, you don't have a body. This is all a mental state. Okay, from here on out, you're only in mental states. If you put your attention on your body, you're going to feel it. But when you just allow your body to be, you're going to be in this mental state and you're going to start sitting for longer periods of time with staying with your object of meditation. Okay. And the states in the fourth jhana, the equanimity, the neither painful nor pleasant feeling. The mental unconcern due to tranquility. Your mind in the fourth jhana becomes very tranquil and steady, stable. The purity of mindfulness and unification of mind. The contact, feeling, perception, formation, and mind. There's the four foundations again. The enthusiasm, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention. These states were defined by him one by one as they occurred. Known to him those states arose, known they were present, known they disappeared. Now, when you're practicing absorption concentration, your mind will be very much absorbed in just one thing. So you're not going to be able to notice how things change. That's one of the reasons that the Buddha was not enthusiastic about absorption concentration. Although a lot of people practice it and they say, oh, I get into this bliss. I'll be on an object of meditation for a short period of time and this bliss comes and I can sit for a long time in this blissful, happy state. Yes, but are you learning how mind's attention moves from one thing to another? No, because you're hooked on that one thing and it's blissful. Okay, again, with the complete surmounting of gross perceptions of form. When you're sitting in meditation in the lower jhanas, the first three jhanas, you can feel your body. And that's gross perception. With the disappearance of gross perceptions of mental sensory impact. Okay. Now you're getting into the subtle realms where if there's contact while you're sitting and you're in the fourth jhana, you will feel that contact. Again, it's not going to make your mind shake. You're not going to go to it necessarily. Now, a real interesting thing, too, is when you're in one of these jhanas, stay in the jhana when you're getting up and doing your walking meditation. Can you have joy when you're walking? Can you have equanimity when you're walking? Can you feel really comfortable and tranquil when you're walking? So you stay with your object of meditation and when you stay with your object of meditation when you're walking and you come back to your sitting, you can still be in that state and just sit down and start doing it some more. One of the things that we kind of get hooked on when we first start doing the meditation is our mind has hindrances when we walk. And you don't really stay with your object of meditation as well as you could. And then you kind of sometimes let your mind kind of ho-hum around and think about this and think about that, so you're not in the jhana anymore. So when you come back to your meditation and to sit, you have this thought, you know, that last sitting was really good. I want to do that again. And what happens? Your mind becomes so restless, it's unbelievable. Because you think, well, I'll just go back to the way I was. But you've broken that continuity of the practice. And that desire to have it happen again makes your mind restless. That one simple, I just want to do it again. And then you start seeing, well, my mind's restless now. I need to do this. I need to do it with more energy. I have to try harder. And then your mind gets more restless. And before long, you can't sit very well because your mind is so restless. What's the cause of that? That one desire, that one craving to have your meditation be like it was the last time. And this has happened, it's happened to me, it's happened to everybody that I know that meditates, is once that restlessness starts up, you try harder. And you put more energy into it. And that makes it worse. So actually what you need to do is stop trying so hard. Now, as I said, I've done a lot of meditation, and most of my meditation teachers would always try to get me to try harder. Push. You need more mindfulness in that. And actually what you need is to stop and back off. Relax. Stop trying so hard. And that will make the restlessness just start to fade away. Now, in the Samyutta Nikaya, this is the Bhojanga Samyutta, where the Buddha starts talking about what you do and how you use the factors of awakening to keep your mind in balance. Talks where I'm going to be talking about, it talks about sloth and torpor, how to keep your mind in balance with sloth and torpor, and it also talks about restlessness. So the first part is about sluggishness, sloth and torpor, and the untimely thing to do when you have sloth and torpor. On an occasion, when mind becomes sluggish, it is untimely to develop the awakening factor of tranquility, the awakening factor of experience, observation of mind, concentration, and equanimity. Let go of that one thing that I just stumbled on. That wasn't right. For what reason? Because mind is sluggish, and it's difficult to arouse these things. Suppose a man wants to make a small fire flare up. If he throws wet grass, wet cow dung, wet timber into it and sprays it with water and scatters soil over it, would he be able to make a small fire flare up? No, venerable sir. Smart monks, huh? So too, on an occasion when mind becomes sluggish, it is untimely to develop the awakening factor of tranquility, the awakening factor of collectedness, and the awakening factor of equanimity. For what reason? Because mind is sluggish and it's difficult to arouse these things with to calm a mind. Now we have sluggishness, and what's the timely thing to do? On an occasion when mind becomes sluggish, it's timely to develop the awakening factor of experience, observation of your experience, the awakening factor of energy, and the awakening factor of joy. For what reason? Because mind is sluggish, and it's easy to arouse these things when you have sloth and torpor. Suppose a man wants to make a small fire flare up. If he throws dry grass, dry cow dung, dry timber into it, blows on it, does not scatter soil over it, would he be able to make a small fire flare up? Yes, venerable sir, so too. On an occasion when mind becomes sluggish, it is timely to develop the awakening factor of experience of your observation of your experience, the awakening factor of energy, and the awakening factor of joy. For what reason? Because mind is sluggish, and it's easy to arouse these things. Okay, now we're going to talk about restlessness. The excited mind. And what is untimely to do when you have an excited mind? On an occasion when mind becomes excited, it is untimely to develop the awakening factor of observation of your experience, the awakening factor of energy, and the awakening factor of joy. For what reason? Because mind is excited and it's difficult to calm it down with these things. Suppose a monk wants to extinguish a great bonfire. If he throws dry grass, dry cow dung, dry timber into it, blows on it, and does not scatter soil over it, would he be able to extinguish a great bonfire? No, venerable sir. So too, on an occasion when mind becomes excited, it is untimely to develop things that feed into the excitement. Okay, now, what to do with an excited mind in a timely way? On an occasion when mind becomes excited, it's timely to develop the awakening factor of tranquility, the awakening factor of stillness, the awakening factor of equanimity. For what reason? Because mind is excited, and it's easy to calm it down with those things. Suppose a man wants to extinguish a great bonfire. If he throws wet grass, wet cow dung, wet timber into it, sprays it with water and scatters soil over it, would he be able to extinguish a great bonfire? Yes, venerable sir, so too. On an occasion when mind becomes excited, it is timely to develop the awakening factor of tranquility, the awakening factor of calmness or collectedness, the awakening factor of equanimity. For what reason? Because mind is excited, and it's easy to calm it down with those things. And mindfulness, I say, is always useful. I like that statement. So what do you do when you have sloth and torpor? What do you do when you have restlessness? Well, if you have sloth and torpor, you have to pick up your energy. Why does sloth and torpor arise? Because you've lost interest in staying with your object of meditation. So you have to pick up your energy and take an interest in how it arises. What happens first? What happens after that? When you start taking more interest, you start having more energy. So, there's a lot of ways to pick up your energy. The Buddha gave a whole list of them. Go wash your face. The classic is pinch your earlobe as hard as you can. I never found that to be very good. It didn't work very well. But quite often you can be inside and your mind can be very dull. And you go outside and your mind becomes more alert, more expansive feeling. And when you do your walking meditation, pick a place that's 40 or 30 or 40 feet, and you walk staying with your object of meditation, and you get to the end of the walk, don't turn around. Walk backwards and staying with your object of meditation. Not slowly, walk backwards in a normal pace. And you will be able to overcome the sloth and torpor. So, okay. Sariputta, we'll start this again. With the complete surmounting of gross perceptions of form, with the disappearance of gross perceptions of sensory impact, aware that space is infinite. Sariputta entered upon and abided in the base of infinite space. Now, what happens when you get to this state is the feeling of loving kindness disappears and compassion arises by itself. And you will feel expansion happening in your head in all directions at the same time. That is called infinite space. The Buddha sat in this state of compassion with infinite space for 2 hours every morning. Quite often in the suttas, they'll say the Buddha surveyed the world with a mind imbued with loving kindness. This is what he did. And you get to experience it when conditions are right. And the states in the base of infinite space, the perception of the base of infinite space and unification of mind, the contact, feeling, perception, formations, and mind. Now, isn't that interesting? You still have the four foundations of mindfulness, even though you're in an arupa state. You're in a mental state, and you're still experiencing the four foundations of mindfulness. The enthusiasm, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention, these states were defined by him one by one as they occurred. Known to him, those states arose. Known they were present, known they disappeared. He understood there's still more to do, and with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed that there is. Again, by completely surmounting the base of infinite space, aware that consciousness is infinite, Sariputta entered upon and abided in the base of infinite consciousness. Now, the feeling of compassion is going to change to a feeling of joy. This is not the same kind of joy you've experienced before. This kind of joy doesn't have the excitement in it. This is like the awakening factor of joy. It's a happy feeling. You feel real nice. And you're going to start noticing at one of the sense doors. Now, interesting thing about the sense doors, they're all in your head. Right? All the six senses are in your head. What you're going to do is you're going to see individual consciousnesses arise and pass away, arise and pass away, arise and pass away, very, very quickly. And it's going to be like blinking. It's like watching a movie that's a little bit too slow, and you see individual pictures and the blank spot in between them. It's going to be like that. Now, this is a very good state because it's showing you everything truly is impermanent. It arises, it's there, it disappears. Everything in the universe is like this. And because there's this constant arising and passing away, that it gets tiresome to watch it. It's always happening very fast. That was 100,000 ear-conscious, sound for ear-consciousness. And now you're starting to see them individually, even though they're happening very fast. And you're going to see that there's no controller. This happens because conditions are right for it to happen. You're truly seeing what Anatta is talking about. When conditions are right, these things start happening and you're going to see them. And you're going to say, I didn't bring that up. Happened all by itself. So this is a very important state because you're seeing up close and personal anicca, dukkha, anatta. And you're seeing that these are real. It's not a philosophy. Okay, and the states in the base of infinite consciousness and joy. The perception of the base of infinite consciousness and joy. And unification of mind, the contact, feeling, perception, formations, and mind. There's the foundations again. An interesting thing that almost nobody really understands is the four foundations of mindfulness is describing jhana practice. And when somebody gives a Dhamma talk, they just say, well, this is body, this is feeling, this is mind, this is mind objects. But they don't understand that it's talking about how to do the jhana practice. And if you have any doubt about that, go to the mind objects. And what's the first thing in the mind objects? How to let go of hindrances. And it shows you how to practice the six R's and how to purify your mind. So it's quite an interesting phenomena. All the mind objects are talking about, if you go to the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, it's talking about the links of dependent origination. But it's real hard to understand it because of the poor translation of the Digha Nikaya. I've threatened, but I haven't gotten to it yet, to rewrite the whole Digha Nikaya so that you can understand it more clearly. Especially the Satipatthana Sutta. His translation of that is very poor, and you don't really realize that it's talking about dependent origination. So it's got to be made clearer. Okay. The enthusiasm, decision, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention, these states were defined by him one by one as they occurred. Known to him, those states arose, known they were present, known they disappeared. He understood there's still more to do, and with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed that there is. Again, monks, by completely surmounting the base of joy and infinite consciousness, aware that there is nothing, Sariputta entered upon and abided in the base of nothingness. Now what it's talking about here is mind is not looking outside of itself anymore. Mind is watching mind. And the joy that you had from the last state goes away, and equanimity takes its place. Now, this is all very natural. It happens all by itself. You don't make it happen. And this is a really interesting state. There's lots of neat things that can happen in this state, and you have to tell me about it, because if I tell you, then all of a sudden you're going to repeat back what I said without seeing it. So I don't want to do that. But when you have this equanimity, this very, very strong balance of mind, it's always fun to be around somebody that experiences that, because they come in for the interview, I say, hey, how's it going? Everything is fine. They have such balance in their mind and such balance coming out with what they're saying. You having fun with this meditation? Yeah, everything is fine. It's good. No excitement in their mind at all. There's just this exquisite balance. Now, with this particular state, you can be staying with it very nicely, and all of a sudden your mindfulness slips a little bit or changes a little bit, and you might start to have some restlessness arise. That means You're staying too tightly with your object of meditation, which is the equanimity. Or if your mindfulness slips and your mind starts to dull out a little bit, you need to pick up your energy so that you can stay in balance. This is like walking on a spider web, a tightrope. You try too hard, restless. Not quite enough, dull. And as I said, there are a lot of other interesting things that can happen that are real fun. And as you go deeper into your meditation, now you're going to start sitting for longer periods of time. And you'll be able to sit without having a whole lot of distractions in your mind. And with each of these different states that I've been describing, the loving kindness, the compassion, the joy, the equanimity, when you experience that with your sitting, then that's your object of meditation. Okay, so the next time you sit, you do the six directions with that. If it's compassion, you do six directions with compassion and all directions at the same time. If it's joy, you do the same thing. If it's equanimity, you do the same thing. So with equanimity, you'll get to a place where you're radiating equanimity to all beings at this, in all directions. And the equanimity fades away, just disappears. For a lot of people, when this happens the first time or the second time, they'll feel like they were asleep and aware at the same time. What's happening is, when you first started doing the meditation, your mind was flip-flopping. And as you go deeper in the meditation, there's less movement and there's more staying on your object of meditation. When you get into the arupa states, now you're working with vibrations, okay? And as you go from one state to the next, the vibrations become less and less until it's hard to tell whether there's any vibration there at all. And that's neither perception nor non-perception. So after this, it doesn't last very long, this feeling of being asleep and aware, you start becoming more, your mindfulness starts to pick up a little bit and you start seeing the slight movements. And what happens is your mind will just become very, very peaceful and calm for long periods of time. No movement of mind's attention at all. You might see a slight movement of mind's attention. When you do, you six-R that at first. Then when it gets a little more subtle, just relax. Stay with that quiet, balanced mind. Now you should be sitting 3 hours, 4 hours like that, because you need the time with the quiet mind. When you come out of that state, you want to take a couple of minutes and reflect on what happened while you were in that state, because this is neither perception nor non-perception. It's kind of there and it's kind of not, is basically what it's saying. But when you reflect on that, then you can see that there were some things that you hadn't actually noticed very much. And when you reflect on it, you'll know, oh yeah, that happened. So you six are that, just let it be. Now, after a period of time, when your mind is ready, you can be really peaceful, really calm, exquisite, quiet. And then all of a sudden, everything stops. Just like turning the lights off, blink. That is called the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. You'll be in that state for a period of time. You don't really know you're in that state until you come out, because there's no consciousness. How do you know when you're in something like that? It just stops. But when you come out, you will be very alert, and you will feel a sense of relief, like you've been carrying a backpack that had rocks in it, and you all of a sudden put it down. Ah, very nice. And if your mindfulness is real sharp, you'll be able to see these little tiny blinking things that happen, even more subtle than before. And then you will have really strong joy arise. You will be happy. And that joy will last for a few days. It's really nice. When that experience happens, you have experienced Nibbana. You have become a Sotapanna or whatever. So you come in and tell me about it, and I have certain questions that I'm going to ask you and test whether you really saw it or not, or really had that experience. And everything is going to change. Okay? You're not going to want to break a precept for any reason at all. And if you break a precept, you will feel so guilty that you can't stand it. You have to go tell somebody, I broke this precept. Then you take the precepts again with the determination, I'm not going to do that again, because it's just not worth it. You're not going to have any doubt ever arise again that this is the right path. You know this is the right way. It changes your perspective, the way you see things. You know that rites and rituals do not lead to Nibbana. And you're going to see the impersonal nature of things much more clearly. And it changes your perspective in your everyday life. So when you tell me, and I, after answering some questions that I'm going to ask you, I'm going to say, oh, congratulations, you really did good. You've given up an ocean of suffering. You're never going to be reborn less than a human being. You're not going to be reborn in a hell realm. You're not going to be reborn in a ghost realm. You're not going to be reborn as an animal. You're going to be reborn as a human being. And that, there's a big relief that happens with that. And then I'm going to say, really good. Now go back and sit. And I'll give some changes in your meditation, just minor changes, not any big deal. So this kind of change is very, very profound. But I highly recommend that if you have this kind of experience, you don't talk about it with just anybody. Because you're going to be challenged. And there's going to be people that are doing other kinds of meditation, and they might have some experience that they call Nibbana that doesn't match with what it says in the suttas. And they're going to try to talk you out of it. You don't know what you're talking about. You didn't have any experience like that. But you will know that there has been a change in perspective. And you will know that the precepts are really, really important. And you won't want to break them. And if you do happen to make a mistake and you break them, forgive yourself for breaking a precept right there. Take the precepts and then make a determination, I'm not going to do that again. It's too painful to have this kind of guilty feeling walking around. So your mind is going to be much more clear, and your perspective of all life is going to start to lighten up and become more, things are more fun. And it is a major change that you go through. So I'm going to tell you, okay, now go back and sit. And you'll go through the same thing again. You'll go through periods of time where you're with neither perception nor non-perception, and your mind just becomes really, really exquisitely quiet. And you're making a huge amount of good merit. Because there's no craving in your mind at that time. So you're purified your mind. Really nice. And eventually, when conditions are right, this whole experience will happen again. You'll have a cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. When you come back from that, you're going to feel even more relief. And you'll start seeing a little bit more with some students when they get to the fruition. Some of them see little bubbles, some seen little dashes, some seen some kind of very small little arising and passing away of phenomena. And then they will have even a stronger joy arise. And it's great. And that'll last for a few days. And it doesn't actually go away. What happens is you get so used to having the joy, it's no big deal anymore. So your mind is uplifted more of the time. Doesn't mean you can't get knocked off balance and have anger or dissatisfaction arise, or fear even. But you won't be caught with it for as long. Now, I had a lady in Malaysia that she would get angry at her husband, and she would stay angry for a week and a half or 2 weeks. Really, really, I mean, she was hard to be around for the week and a half or 2 weeks. She was always grumpy. And she started doing loving kindness with me. And over a period of time, the anger that she had went from a week and a half to a week. And she didn't have time to do a retreat. She was just doing half an hour every day. That was it. So after a period of time, she would stay mad at her husband for 4 days. And then it got down to 2 days. And then it got down to half a day. And then it got down to 10 or 15 minutes. Okay, that's the advantage of doing loving kindness. This isn't a wish that it happens. I mean, I read to you last night, what's the advantage of doing loving kindness? You overcome ill will. So the more you practice, the more you're serious with the practice, and you do it often, and you carry your meditation with you, with your daily activities. That's going to start changing your perspective. You're going to become a different kind of person than you were before. You're going to have a much lighter perspective of things, and you're going to start having more and more balance in your mind. So you're not going to get caught for as long with that unwholesome state, whatever it happens to be. So you come and tell me you've had this experience, and I have some other kinds of questions that I ask just to see whether it's really true. But one of the things I want you to understand, if you have had this experience, you verify it for yourself. You see if your perspective has changed, if your mind has gotten lighter, if your mindfulness is sharper, if you see a hindrance coming up, are you going to be caught with it as long? Are you going to notice it in 6R with your daily activities? Okay, these are kind of the kind of changes, but you have to verify it for yourself. I'm not the expert. I can only go with what you tell me your experience was, but if that isn't quite as accurate as it could have been, and I say, well, you've become a sotapanna, you verify for yourself. You see the changes that you start going through for yourself. I'm not going to be 100% accurate. Wish I was, but that takes a Buddha. I'm not one. So you come and you tell me you had this experience, and I go, just great, congratulations, you're really doing well. Go back and sit. And the same kind of thing is going to happen again. But this time when it happens, you've become what's called a Sakadagami. It's a once returner, which means that after you have this experience, you're only going to be reborn a human being one more time. That's it. Now, what happens when you become a Sakadagami is the lust and hatred are quite a bit less. You can still have some, but you're going to catch it more quickly. You're going to see, you know, this really hurts. Why do I want to do that to myself? So you start changing some of your old habitual tendencies, and your personality starts softening a bit. And then you're going to go through the same experience again, and that would be the fruition of that, where it's really cemented in. It's really good. It's a very good, solid foundation. And after that happens, I congratulate you again, and then I say, okay, go back and sit. Now, if you have this experience again, this is like the man I was talking about a couple days ago, that has nothing in his mind, he has no distractions, he has loving kindness, he has strong mindfulness, he has good concentration, and he's happy all the time. Okay, that's called an anagami, where lust and hatred don't arise anymore. Nice. Really good. Now imagine living the rest of your life without ever being afraid, without ever having any anxiety about anything, without having any upset in your minds. You have this equanimity in your mind that's very strong. And there's still good things and bad things that are going to happen, but it doesn't affect your mind. Okay, that's this and that's that. That's okay. Very worth it to get to these states. Now, all of these different states that I've been talking to you about, can you experience them in this retreat? Yes. I have people that had become sotapanna with fruition. There's one lady that she just, every day, she just went up another notch. And she got up to the fruition of anagami. And the next day I'm thinking, okay, this is it. And didn't happen. No arahatship with that one. But it's not like it's bad. I mean, she was an anagami, and she did have a mind that's like the man I'm just talking about. I have a number of students that have that experience. And it's really worth it. If you think about being a teacher and you have this deep experience of the meditation, any question you get asked, there's no hesitation in the answer that you would give, and it'll be correct. So it really gets to be fun. If you feel the desire to be a teacher. I know a lot of people do, but they don't understand what it means to be a teacher. To be a teacher, you have to be able to say the same thing over and over again with the same enthusiasm. How many times have you heard me say 6R? How many times have you heard me say smile? You have to be able to say these kind of things over and over, because we like to be able to hear it a lot before we really take it to heart. And then once you have the experience, then it's coming from your heart. I love to be around my students that are anagami. There's so much fun to be around. And we giggle and laugh quite a bit. And we discuss very deep kinds of Dhamma that are truly fascinating. I mean, it's real fun. So, y'all get busy. But Well, a lot of the people that are Anagami are not in this country. They're kind of spread out all over. So what I've just done, what I've just explained in this whole Dhamma talk is the entire path of meditation. This is the whole of the Eightfold Path, except I didn't talk about arahatship because I don't know about it. But knowing and hearing this kind of talk can give you a lot of confidence and give you a lot of good insights into where you are and what you're doing, because most of the time I don't tell you where you are until you start getting into the deeper states so we can talk about things, more subtle things. So, my strongest wish for you is to be happy. And follow the directions that I give you. They're not my directions. It's from the Buddha. I don't have anything to do with it. This is all stuff I learned. So follow the directions as closely as you can. Don't add anything, don't subtract anything. And if you do that, I will give you a guarantee. You will be successful. When you get to the fourth jhana, your understanding, because of your direct experience, you'll be able to pick up some of the suttas and read them and you go, yeah, that's right. I didn't think of it that way. Or you'll just start to get more and more insights. So getting to the fourth jhana, of all of my students, 75% of my students have gotten at least to the fourth jhana, and that is being successful. It's still a low percentage of people that have attained Nibbana. It's probably only, with all of the students, it's probably somewhere around 30%. But some places I go, there's 70% of the people that have an experience of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, and the experience of Nibbana. So, I want you to be serious with the practice, but I want you to be seriously happy. Keep your mind light. Okay? Anybody have a question?
Bhante, I have a request that those who do have questions speak up, so they can be heard by those of us whose hearing is not what it used to be.
Okay.
So I have one on jhanas. In your experience, when one has spent time with absorption concentration, do they tend to slide in these directions easily, or is it difficult? And the reason I ask, because absorption concentration is based off intention, right?
Right.
And when you intend to get into an absorption state, the experience, there's no craving involved. It's a beautiful mind state.
I'm sorry, that intention is your craving.
So it's okay, so even though the experience,
see, the thing with absorption concentration that a lot of people really don't understand is that the force of the concentration suppresses the hindrances while your concentration is good. Now, hindrances are where your attachments are. When you come out of absorption concentration, is there personality change? Yeah, but what? How about the rest of the time?
Now you're back to who you are.
Right. So there's no real personality change, and you still have the same hindrances and the same angers and frustrations and whatever.
Right.
But when you practice this way, they let go.
And the reason I ask is if it's easy or hard is sometimes I can tell. The mind is so used to craving that experience. Now you're actually asking it to settle back. You know what I mean?
I understand what you're saying, and I do understand your question. Mm-hmm. And it's not bad that you've done absorption concentration and gotten into these different states. It's not bad. It's just the end result is not going to be the same. So when you come and you've already got good concentration, so your progress in the meditation when you do it this way and you follow the directions is going to be very fast because you've already got concentration. You just have to pick up your mindfulness so it's more in balance. So it's not a waste of time that you did that. And I was telling you yesterday or the day before, the guy that he'd done serious meditation with absorption for 10 years. Then he ran across one of my YouTubes. He started thinking about doing some loving kindness meditation. And he got the instructions. He practiced for 3 days before he came to the retreat. First day of the retreat, he became a sotapanna. So that all of that concentration that he's been developing for 10 years isn't a waste of time. But the end result, if you don't change the meditation, is not going to be the same as what people experience when they have that relaxed step. And that's the key. I don't care what meditation you're doing. You add the relaxed step and you keep adding the relaxed step and you keep 6R-ing so that you don't get caught in the one-pointed or absorption. And let's face it, absorption is really nice. It's very blissful. It's very nice. But your mind gets stuck on that and you don't really learn anything. You don't really learn the links of dependent origination. You don't really learn seeing anicca dukkha anatta in every link. You don't really see the Four Noble Truths as clearly as you can. What happens is you start using it as a philosophy, not something to directly experience. And that's one of the problems with the one-pointed or absorption concentration. And it's so pleasant, it's hard to let it go. You know, I've had a lot of students that they start practicing, say, loving kindness meditation, and they have these hindrances come up, and they'll go, I'm going to go back to my other way. I had a lot of bliss with that. This is hard. It is different. It does get simpler, especially when you keep your smile going and don't allow your mind to go so deep in the concentration that it blocks other things from happening. Okay? Yeah.
It's kind of a personal question, but we talked about all the jhanas, and with forgiveness meditation, I have to stay on the first jhana, and I'm
right
here for 2 more days.
That's all right.
It's okay?
Yeah.
Stay with forgiveness?
Yeah.
Okay. Thought I'd ask.
Well, I did forgiveness meditation for 2 years. You're doing it for 2 days. But I knew that I was going to be teaching it, so I had to find out everything that I needed to clear out so that I could be able to explain it to other people. And it's a fantastic meditation. It's really remarkable how much lighter you feel. And we, you know, I did something when I was a little kid. I was maybe 4 or 5 years old, and my mom asked me something, and I flat out lied to her. My mind grabbed onto that, and it affected the way I saw the world for 45 years until I finally let it go. I didn't know, I didn't remember doing that, but staying with the forgiveness and then seeing the guilty feeling I had and let go of the pain of that, still have the memory of doing it, but the letting go of the pain of that, that's the relief. Yeah.
As everybody who's come to your retreats notes, it's an amazing experience, and there's no question about that. And you have incredible levels of success that nobody else is matching at all, which is really what attracted me into this, because I couldn't find it anywhere else. But what one runs across, and this is where I'm asking for your advice, is I see that some of the people who I know here who are really regular meditators, who are doing quite a lot of meditation, you know, in the week in a normal way, are really getting a great benefit from doing that. And that introduces the issue of what is a good kind of background, sort of everyday level of meditation that you think is necessary. Obviously, it varies by person, clearly. But in order to speed up the process when you hit a retreat, what would you suggest? And I know it's going to be variable between people. And thank you for
well,
that.
Well, actually, it's a lot simpler than you think. Mm-hmm. You keep the precepts without breaking them. Mm-hmm. You break a precept, you feel guilty, whether you really recognize that guilt or not, and the hindrances are going to come back, and they're going to be troublesome. I've had students that they say, oh, when I get off retreat, now I can go back to being the way I was. Okay. So if you break a precept, you're going to have more hindrances coming up. This is a serious thing. And ever since I started meditation back in the 70s, I was always told, well, it's only morality. And there's the Christian morality that people, they hear a lot about, but there's no actual practice for it. keeping the precepts changes the way you see the world. And the more you keep the precepts without breaking them, it turns into protection for you. And you've heard me say this more than once. If you take care of Dhamma, Dhamma will take care of you. Okay? And that literally means keep the precepts. That's taking care of the Dhamma.
Yeah. Yes, obviously you're right there. But I feel that there's a practice component as well. It's like riding a bike, we don't need to practice, but there are so many skills that to keep them, you have to practice them.
Well, how many times do you hear me say smile during the retreat? And carry the smile with you.
Mm-hmm. But do you think that there is no practice factor involved in maintaining a meditation?
Sit every day.
Okay, how long for?
Oh, don't ever, yeah. 8 hours. 8 hours. It's only a third of the day. You still have 16 hours to do whatever you gotta do. Well, actually, you try to sit as much as you can. And I honestly believe that the best way to do the practice is by sitting in the morning. Mm-hmm. It's a nice way to start the day. Your mind is pretty alert. And then if you feel like sitting at other times during the day, then do that. And there are times when you feel like your mind is really, really running all over and doing this and doing that, and it seems like your mind is extra scattered. Well, sit down for 5 or 10 minutes and start relaxing and bringing up a feeling of tranquility. When you do that, you become much more efficient with what you're doing while you do it.
Thank you, that's very helpful.
Okay, yeah.
And I think it's better to have the air sitting too much than too little.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think that's
is it an error? Anything else?
I have just a little question.
Yeah.
The precepts are pretty easy for me to keep, but about maybe once every 3 or 4 months, I love to get tipsy with my girlfriends and get silly. And I don't really notice, I feel like a little bit of guilt come up.
As long as you're not gossiping and making up stories, you don't have to worry about it too much. It's okay to have fun. It's okay to get silly. You don't have to feel guilty about that.
It's how she's getting silly.
Yeah. Well, that's... Well, I was trying to be polite.
Well,
great. Do it more than once every 3 or 4 months.
Are you talking about yourself? Exactly. Oh, yes.
Oh, that's not so good. You have a tendency to break the other precepts when you do alcohol. And I can tell if you come to do a retreat whether you've been doing alcohol or not, because your mind is fuzzy, your mind is dull. So
even like 3 times a year.
Well, you can make an excuse for anything if you want to, but I'll give you an example how it's a protection. I kept my precepts fairly closely. I really did. And I went with some friends and we started climbing trees. And we were up maybe 40 or 50 feet in the air. And I decided to come down, and I stepped on a branch and it broke, and I fell all the way down to this little V that happened with two different branches, and my leg caught there. My body went, and I didn't quite touch the ground. Yeah, it was a protection. You will not die of an accident, a car accident or whatever. You won't die an unnatural death. Generally speaking, people that die in accidents, they don't have a good rebirth because they have dislike. How many people do you know, excuse my French for saying this, they get into close to an accident and they go, shit! Do you want to die with a mind like that? Now the thing with keeping a precepts, over longer and longer periods of time, you become much more aware of what you're going to do and what you're going to say before you do it. So you make the decision of how you're going to do it. And it does help your general mindfulness. So it's up to you. I'm not going to be your father confessor for these kind of things. It's your choice what you want to do. But I really don't recommend it. So, anything else?
Thanks for asking.
When you say jhana is a level of understanding of what?
Well, you start understanding, when you get to the first jhana, you start understanding hindrances, how they arise and what to do to get rid of them. You start understanding what it feels like to have joy and happiness. There's all these different levels of understanding. And as you go deeper into your practice, you start understanding more and more clearly how this process actually does work. And how everything is impersonal. Good fun.
I have a question. It's technical, but in the sutta, you use the word attention.
Yeah.
So what's a Pali word that they're translating into attention? Is it sati?
No.
Manasikara.
Well, it kind of depends on what your mood is at the time. Sometimes the words will... It's not coming to me.
Google. I'll Google it.
Yeah.
Just curious. I thought it might be sati, but no.
Oh, sati is always mindfulness.
Always.
Yeah. And that means seeing how the process works. It almost came. Don't get old, It's not good.
See, they also use, in some of the suttas, he uses wise attention.
That's talking about seeing how things work through dependent origination.
Okay. I'll Google it.
Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
When you talk about the precepts, do you mean like everything, including no music and dancing?
No, five precepts.
Okay.
Yeah, the only reason that the Buddha gave us eight precepts was for special occasions. If you sing and dance, you have a tendency to lose your mindfulness sometimes. And adorning the body, you spend too much time doing that sort of thing. And the discipline of not eating after the noonday meal. All of these lead to more discipline for a period of time. Now, there are people that take eight precepts, and there are people that take 10 precepts. And they generally take the ropes when they do that sort of thing, because it's not an easy path. And, but keeping the five precepts, yeah, that's the one. And you only have five. I have 227. Okay? Let's share some merit then. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, Jesus and Nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu.